Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.
You deserve more than feeling constantly fried to a crisp. Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast, where you get the understanding, the community, and the information you need to end burnout for good. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, and all of my work focuses on hashtag ending burnout culture. Outside the pod, you'll find me on stages at conferences giving keynotes, in offices providing corporate trainings, doing virtual VIP one-on-one work, or supporting our group program, Unfried, that is run by my right-hand woman, Sarah Vosen. Both Sarah and I have been through burnout and came out stronger, happier, and more fulfilled, and we want that post-burnout growth for you, too. Fried fam, do I have something special for you today? There have been, over the years, a lot of questions about how burnout shows up in relationships, how it affects relationships, how relationships affect it. And not only relationships with couples, but relationships with children. There's been a lot of questions over the year about how do I help my child create a life that's not going to burn them out? And a lot of those answers all come from one place that we have not in 230 plus episodes taken a deep dive into, because I have not found the person until now that I wanted to do the deep dive with. Today, we get to speak with Julie Manano, who is an MA, LMFT, LCPC, a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in emotionally focused therapy for couples. She also provides insight and advice for couples at The Secure Relationship on Instagram with over 1 million followers. She founded and runs the Bozeman Therapy and Counseling Clinic and the Secure Relationship Coaching. She lives in Bozeman, Montana with her husband and six, count them, six children. Julie, warmest welcome to the world of Fried.
Beautiful intro. Your voice is so soothing. I love this already.
Thank you. I never knew that I had a voice for this until I started and people were like, ooh. And I was like, really?
That's so funny because that's how I felt when I recorded the audiobook. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like so soothing and gentle.
If only we could find that soothing and gentleness a little early in our lives, right?
Exactly, right?
So the thing that you talk about most is attachment theory. So we're just going to say that from the get-go, right? Like we're talking about attachment theory, and attachment theory can sort of be broken into two components, secure and insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the title of your book is Secure Love. So guess what, everybody? Secure is what we're going for. And then insecure is broken down into three different components, right? It can be avoidant, it could be anxious, or it can be disordered. Is that the right word? Disorganized.
Yeah. And some people call that fearful avoidant, but yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's do a cap of those things, of what all those things mean to kick things off. I'm going to kind of sit back and give you the stage for a moment. And if it takes us 15, 20 minutes, that like take the time. Let's dig into it so that people understand what we are using for the remainder of the conversation.
Okay. I have lots of different ways of describing this depending on where my mind is in the moment. Right now, my mind is in this place. It is a way to control your fears and anxieties. Your attachment style is how you manage your relationship related fears and anxieties and deeper sadnesses and, you know, lonelinesses. Some people manage those in ways that are very healthy, right? It helped. They dig in, they recognize, okay, this is here. I have these communication skills to use to reach to this person. You know, I talk about romantic relationships, to reach to my partner, to share with them what's going on with me and to get some sort of resolution between the two of us so that I can get back to a place of inner security where we're feeling loved, cared for, stable, not scared, not alone, right? If someone has an anxious attachment, their way of dealing with those big feelings is kind of panicky. Oh my gosh, get desperate, close the distance, take action, do something, come in hot, demand, protest, something to get kind of big, for lack of a better word, emotionally big, lots of energy to, again, we're trying to close that distance. If I can just close the distance, if I can just get you to come back, if I can just get you to see what you're doing wrong, then I don't have to sit here with these big fears and feelings that I don't know what to do with because nobody in my life ever helped me with them. Now we have avoidant attachment. Avoidant attachment is, I don't like this stuff. I don't like these fears. I don't like these sadnesses. So what I'm going to do is just pretend they're not there and subconsciously just shut them off, put a lid on it, put it away, go forward with life. But in the process, they're cutting off a part of themselves and they're cutting off their ability to help other people in their dark places that they can't see because they can't see it in themselves. Then we have disorganized. Now we take a blender and we pour in some anxious and we pour in some avoidant. And now we pour in a little trauma and we pour in a whole lot of unpredictability and a whole lot of really big emotions, turn the blender on and pour it into a glass. And that's disorganized attachment.
We talk a lot on Friday about something that I like to call the emotional soup. And it's sort of like the energetic world that we're living in and what we're carrying around with us when we go places like the grocery store, and how I believe, and this is something that I believe that you share because I heard you talk about this on another podcast, that I believe that our part of our job here as we grow spiritually as humans is to be as secure and as light and as joyful as we can be, because we carry that around and it hits the people around us.
Oh yeah. So true. Yep.
Right. So I ask my clients often, what ingredient in this situation, what ingredient are you adding to the emotional or energetic soup? And is it the flavor that you want?
Be a little more specific. So, oh no, you're not asking me.
Are no,
you asking
no, no,
oh,
no.
Oh, got no. it. Yeah. Okay. Right. Ask me that. I was okay.
No, no. So
that's a great question, though. I get it.
Just something to get us thinking about the fact that what we carry around with us is, whether or not we are doing it intentionally and whether or not we're even in conversation with people sometimes, is spilling over into our world. So it's so important. These attachment styles, according to all the research, most of this is related to nature versus nurture, right? This is mostly nurture stuff.
Nurture. Yeah.
This is the nurture side of stuff. So this is how you were treated as a child. One of the things that I read in your book that I underlined immediately said that in order for a child to develop secure attachment, to develop this healthy style of attaching, of communicating, of having relationships with other people, they only need to be exposed to that style of secure attachment from their parents, caregivers, et cetera, 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, Fried Fam, the first bit of grace I want you to give yourself today is, if you are a parent or a caregiver and you can be present and secure and balanced 50% of the time, you are killing it.
Absolutely. You know what that means. You know what it is enough to do it. You know, half of the time, the other half of the time, we just kind of have to learn to help ourselves. You know, we need that other 50% or 30% or whatever it is for that individual to be resilient.
So I want you to understand, mostly from that you, if you're carrying some things over that are unexplored from your childhood and underdeveloped from your childhood, that doesn't necessarily mean right away that you're making all the mistakes, and that if you're not able to be secure for your child 100% of the time, then it's not enough. You can raise a child that's going to be resilient as long as you're doing it half the time, which I think is like pretty relieving.
I think, honestly, you know, too much of it, first of all, the only way people could do too much of it is if they're doing it anxiously, you know, because we all have lives. I think if a child has too much constant support and help with their feelings in this kind of very helicoptery way. They'd never learn how to deal with the real world and go to a job where nobody is caring about your feelings, maybe in that environment. And so there's something to be said for having to, you know, help our learn to help ourselves. But that 50% gives the child the modeling, the experience. Yeah.
I love that. And then the other 50% of the time, what happens during childhood that could create an anxious attachment style, for instance?
Just not getting enough emotional support, not getting enough moments where you can reach to your caregiver. I'm upset, I'm stressed out. You know, maybe you don't do it with words, but children just, you know, their emotions show. You're not getting responded to. You're not getting help. You're not getting guidance. You're not getting comfort. Here's what's happening for you. You're mad and it makes sense. And here, let me give you a hug, whatever that looks like. Instead, you're getting shamed. You're getting rejected. You're getting punished. You're getting sent away. And, you know, that ends up leaving people feeling like they just, they don't, first of all, they're alone. And then that leaves a lot of grief and a lot of anger that now is going to seep out all over the place. And it leaves not knowing how to help yourself, never learning how to help yourself in those places. And when we don't know how to help ourselves, you know, we'll talk about this later, but we're going to go into all sorts of ways, junk food ways to help ourselves that really don't help us get our, like I said, I mean, junk food, meaning that, yeah, you're getting the food, but you're not getting the nourishment. You're overfed, undernourished.
Overfed, undernourished is a good descriptor for the burnout community. Is it the same? Would the same issues lead to an avoidant attachment style, or would that be different treatment from parent to child that would,
you know,
it, that way?
Some kids, I think, when we talk about nature and nurture, you know, people are born with different temperaments, right? Yeah. And some people might just be more biologically made up or genetically made up to handle their emotions with avoidance. Mm. Their emotions aren't quite as intense. Someone who's a highly sensitive person and they feel everything and they notice everything that's going wrong, they're probably going to be more likely to develop an anxious attachment. You know, I'll give you an example. I have 6 kids and all five of my children were just super easy, calm babies. And then Sophie came along and she was a twin. And even her twin was a super calm baby, but Sophie was crying all the time, nonstop, okay, nonstop crying. At that point, they were my 4th and 5th. I knew just to hold her and give her whatever she needed and sleep with her. And that, you know, that's what she needed. Her nervous system was really needing me physically close and regulating her. And to this day, Sophie is a very sensitive, very artistic, needs to talk about her feelings. I know when Sophie needs to talk about her feelings because she starts to, you know, I can just tell by her behavior and literally a 30-minute conversation and she gets it out and she cries about things going on at school. She's good. She's good for a few days, you know. So yeah, her temperament was going to, you know, any insecure attachment issues that she had were going to show up as anxiety, an anxious attachment.
Right.
She didn't because I knew how to deal with her, but that's what's going to happen for her temperament if things go wrong. But someone who they just kind of temperamentally can put it down and then they get rewarded from society. Oh, look how good you are. Look how easy you are for pushing it down. Then they're even more likely to push it down. And, you know, they can go the other way. So I have seen people who have really anxious parents become avoidant and people who have very avoidant parents become anxious. Yeah, it's really.
So there's the nature piece.
There's the nature piece. But then the insecure attachment period, whatever category you're in, is 100% nurture. 100%. It's a relationally driven disorder.
So what about disorganized?
Disorganized is just the strategies aren't as consistent. Someone with an anxious attachment, they got enough consistency in their environment that their strategies sort of half worked. If I get really big, if I protest, I'll get responded to. If I do this or if I do that, I'll get responded to. And they kind of learn, you know, the anxious behaviors get parents' attention, get caregivers' attention. The avoidant learned, stuff it down, be a high achiever, you know, don't rock the boat, don't create conflict, whatever. that's going to get me feeling a sense of like, at least these people are happy with me, right? At least I'm not getting in trouble. At least I'm avoiding, you know, all these bad things from happening. Or I can sort of self-medicate and kind of get absorbed into fantasy worlds or whatever. Someone with a disorganized attachment, their environment was so chaotic and unpredictable. They didn't really get to develop a consistent strategy. It was kind of like, this might work, this might work. And if nothing works, I just fall apart emotionally.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So, yeah. And I did write an article for Psychology Today that's online right now that talks about disorganized.
Perfect.
Yeah.
One of the things that you said on another podcast was that when you first had children and before you were aware of these things, you thought that you had chaos growing up. So you thought that to provide lack of chaos, to provide structure and mm-hmm. to create a like sort of a clean cut environment where the rules were clear and everybody was clean and ironed and dressed and
yes.
that was providing for your children in the proper way. And you didn't realize until later. And when you went back to school, when you started explaining this, my whole body was like, oh my God, it's my mother.
Yeah.
My mother did exactly the same. And my mother and I have talked about this quite a bit over the years. If we were brushed and our hair was done and our clothes were ironed and we were doing well in school and our house was clean and we had, you know, the right shoes and we did, then everything was good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I was listening to that and I was like, yeah, everything is safe. Mm-hmm. Right. And it took me until I burnt out and then started to recover to realize that emotional neglect was part of my childhood. And I didn't know that before because my family's quite close and we're quite happy and I love my parents and I don't blame them or think that they're terrible people or
other that you're able to hold both of those truths too.
And so that was a huge part of my recovery, understanding that I just didn't get those things. I got a lot of other things.
And listen, exactly. I was going to say, thank God you got what you did get, right? You did get structure. You did get a good education. All those things are valuable. And I never want to say, oh, that doesn't matter because you didn't get this. But we're all just looking at, okay, here's where the holes were. You know, if you have a parent who is the most emotionally supportive person in the world, but they're not creating any structure, they're not having you go to school every day, that's a problem too. So make sure it's all happening.
So one of the things we talk about a lot here is removing blame because it's not useful.
It's not. Anger is useful.
Yeah.
That blame is not useful.
We call resentment a superpower in these parts.
Okay.
So yes, anger, resentment, useful emotions, blame, not helpful, whether it's self-blame or other blame, not helpful. That was something that I noticed throughout the book that you kept reminding people that whatever their style was or whatever was happening or whatever the thing, there's no blame involved. It's just, hey, let's look at this and talk about what's going on so that we can fix it. So I want to get to the junk food now.
All right.
You say in the beginning of the book, I'm going to open it so I can read it exactly. You say, the problem is that we live in a world where it's rare for a person to be in touch with their greatest, yet most basic needs. Most of us have never learned how to label our needs, and we've never learned to notice our needs on the bodily level on which they occur. For my community in particular, this lack of connection, this lack of knowledge around our own needs is massive. It's why we ended up here.
Yes.
What are those needs? Because sometimes we're like, what do you think you need? And people are like, I don't know.
You know, right here and now, we're having this conversation. And we're in this contained environment mm-hmm. where we don't impact each other's real lives. There's not high emotional stakes, right? So we don't have a lot of like, you know, energy built up with each other. We're just sitting here. Both of us I'll speak for myself. I feel understood. I feel appreciated. I feel heard. I feel like I have a place to be authentic. And that is causing my nervous system to feel at ease. Okay. If you were being really critical, or if you were like kind of pushing my buttons or talking over me, or, you know, kind of challenging everything that came out of my mouth, I would not be feeling at ease. I would be feeling threatened. I would be feeling misunderstood. I would be feeling like, you know, unappreciated for what I have to share and talked over and disrespected. And so that is it. It's just harder to get there. It's harder because who checks in and says in a podcast, my needs are being met, right? Yet no, they are, right? And so it's, right. I don't know if I'm putting in the right words, but that's what I'm needing from the couples I work with to experience with each other. I need them when they're interacting to feel what I'm feeling right now and probably what you're feeling right now. Now, it gets more complicated when we have overlapping lives and we start bringing conflict onto the table and we see things differently. And we, you know, and so I need to help them have those differences, have those conflicts, but not lose this feeling understood, feeling seen. We can disagree. We can do all these things, and we can even choose to break up from a place of mutual respect, appreciation, validation, understood, having being heard, having everybody have their voice matter.
Fried fam, I tell you in nearly every episode that step one of your burnout recovery is blood work. And I know that a lot of you avoid it because it's a pain and because your doctor has told you that everything is quote unquote fine. And they refuse to test all the things that you think you need. What if I told you that you could test what you want, when you want, from your home with just a couple of drops of blood? SciFox Health allows you to do just that. You can buy tests as one-offs or join a membership. Either way, you can test and track your results to help you make decisions about your burnout recovery journey. Get 10% off any membership, subscription, or one-time test kit right now. Go to scifoxhealth.com/fried for your discount. That's scifoxhealth.com/fried. You mentioned quite a few times that understanding is probably the biggest and most important need.
Yes, definitely. Because it's de-shaming.
Let's do that more.
Okay. Understanding is, you know, the way that I define understanding is, I get you're not a bad person. You think the way you do politically because you're really, that's your way of trying to achieve something, feel good inside, make the world a better place so you can feel good inside, whatever it is. It's not because you're evil. Are evil people there? Do the evil people exist? Sure. I think evil exists in the world. I don't think anybody's born evil, but let's just put that to the side. It's, you make sense to me. And it's not because you're just this bad or unworthy or weak person. And so if someone's really willing to understand you, you're getting a lot of messages from them. You're getting the message, A, my needs matter to you because you're even caring to understand me. B, you respect where I'm coming from. C, you have some level of acceptance for me and what I have to say. All of that is the antidote to shame. Everybody's going around trying to feel safe, trying to not feel alone, trying to not feel rejected. And that's, you know, the vehicle to getting those, to getting feeling accepted is understanding and validation and acceptance. And they're all kind of, you know, when you, I'm breaking them apart, but they're all sort of the same, you know, glob that's de-shaming.
One of the things that this reminds me of is a previous guest. Her name is Dr. Kristen Donnelly. She did a research study on empathy, and she went into the etymology of it, and she looked at the etymology of the word empathy in over 100 languages, just to see what the commonalities were. And what she found to be the common factor was a sense of understanding.
So that's powerful. I made, this was my own, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? I came to the conclusion on my own.
Yeah.
Right now I feel very validated that that's what she discovered. That feels very validating to me. Like, oh, I'm right.
100%. And it's a wonderful thing to know that. Well, maybe I'll go at this from a different angle. Aiming to understand is the greatest gift you can give people is what I get from that. Because if you want people to try and understand you, then your act of aiming to understand other people also invites that action back.
Absolutely.
And what I think happens oftentimes in my community of beautiful people, I love you, Fried family, is that so many of us are so hypersensitive to other people's possible emotions because we learned how to do that as children, like tune in so that we can decide what our reaction is going to be, that we often move straight to, oh, I already know what they're feeling because I experienced this in the past. And this is, I'm empathetic, so I know what they're feeling. And that's not actually empathy, because they're not trying to understand at all. They're skipping. Maybe I'll speak in I sentences. I won't talk for you guys. I'll speak for myself. I have to correct myself on that a lot. I would find myself often skipping over the need to understand by saying, I already know where you're going. Like, I already know what's happening. I can see you're angry. Or I know that this is happening. I can see that you're,
Absolutely.
But slowing that down is actually more healing for both of us.
The phrase that's coming to my mind right now is that empathy comes from a regulated place, a balance of head and heart.
Mm.
Empathy does not come from dysregulation, and it does not come from emotional cutoff. It comes from a balance of head and heart. If it's all heart, we're just kind of overwhelmed with our emotions and we're in a panic and we're trying to make it go away and we're so sad. And, you know, and if it comes from, you know, it can't come from emotional disconnection because we're not able to step into that. So
when it is, when I think it got really popular about 10 years ago for everybody to call themselves empathetic, you know, it was like the big thing. And I kept walking around being like, you're just hypervigilant. That's not empathy.
Gosh, in that period of time, I had so many clients come and say they were an empath. And I was like, you're kind of a sociopath. The world revolves around you, but no, yeah. I'm kidding. I really don't. I don't.
No, of course. But there is this, I wanted to talk about that because I think it's a common thing in my community because it's something that I experienced personally. And it's something that I've heard from multiple people across the years. Fried is going to be 5 this year. And this is something that's come up a lot. And what happens with that hypervigilance, we'll call that the disordered empathy, we'll call it hypervigilance. What happens with that is, I think, or maybe, I don't know if this is a statement or a question or both, is that we make decisions for ourselves and the other person based on non-facts that often lead to further dysregulated relationship.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Does that make sense?
Yes. And sometimes we make those, sometimes it is facts too.
Right.
It's just that we're not dealing with the facts, either real or perceived, in a way that is then healthy. And then we react and we create damage in the way that we react that creates now a new set of facts, real or perceived.
So I'm sitting on that for a moment. We create damage with the way that we react, which then creates a new set of facts, which sometimes reinforces the original set of facts. Usually, that, right?
It's all a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So how do we break this cycle?
We have to do it in two ways. One, we have to learn the skills, the communication skills that create safety and help you get your needs met and help your partner feel that their needs are met, help, right? Not create, not control, but help. And two, we have to get our nervous systems, be able to get our nervous systems into a place of regulation, this balance of head and heart, where we can actually implement those skills. Because if you can't, you can't implement the skills if you're dysregulated. But you also, even if you're trying to implement the skills when you're dysregulated, it's not going to land, because these skills really need to come from a place of, I'm with my emotions right now. I know what I'm feeling. I'm there. I'm not cutting them off, but I'm not so overwhelmed that I can't think straight. And that's a big piece of this work. And I think when I am working with couples, that is the number one thing that will get in their way, is dysregulation. Now, I'm very, very talented and good at helping people regulate, because I'm working with one partner at a time and I'm regulating them by being curious, by understanding, by not shaming them. Some people, however, their layers of dysregulation and trauma are more than I can reach them. And or they're just, you know, whatever it is. And so they need to go, what I do is I send them to go get some somatic experiencing therapy. Yep. So they can learn to kind of find some regulation in themselves so they can participate better in the emotion or the couples therapy. Yeah. But that's it. I mean, it's like, we have to have that regulation piece. We have to have the skills. But the beauty of it is that when we learn the skills and we start implementing them, even if it's not perfect, right, the relationship starts to feel safer, and that creates regulation. So it's all really feeding on itself.
And it can feed on itself negatively or positively, depending on, but that happens either way.
Absolutely. You go in the relationship distress from your childhood wounds or whatever, and that distress starts getting acted out into the relationship. Now the relationship, it has its own created stress that you both brought to it. And that stress becomes an added distress. And so it's just like layers of crap, you know.
Talk about a shit sandwich.
Yes, exactly.
How might this cycle work, this sort of never-ending cycle of things that feed into each other, work with chronic stress and burnout? Like, one of the things that I ask of people typically is, before they make any big changes relationship-wise or job-wise or parenting-wise, is to do some sort of regulation, exactly what you're talking about. Because when you're burnt out and your prefrontal cortex has shrunk and your amygdala is twice the size it's supposed to be and your hippocampus is shrunk and nobody's talking to one another up there,
absolutely,
that space of pause where you're not automatically reacting to something is really hard to come by. You don't have the pause from something happening. Like, you don't, it's just not there.
Yeah.
So
you have to learn to have how to find it. There's no way around it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just the answer. It's just that simple.
Yeah. Now, there's different ways to get there. There's different things you can work on. But if you don't ever develop the pause, you'll never be able to make the changes you need to make.
So if you are in this space of burnout and you see that your relationship is falling apart, or maybe the relationship falling apart was what was, you know, contributing to the burnout in the first place, but you can't fix it until you regulate, mm-hmm, what do you say to your partner in the meantime?
Well, first of all, I think that having access to useful information that is grounding can help you have the pause, because you feel a little bit more of a sense of empowerment. Like, I'm not just going into this blind. We don't know what to say to get our needs met. We don't have the words. We didn't have them modeled to us. We didn't have them communicated to us. Then that's just scary in and of itself. So I like to think of this book I wrote as kind of a secure base. Like, this can help you feel a little more empowered and regulated. And hopefully that can help you get the pause, right? So there are going to be a lot of people who can learn to have that pause just from self-help material, things like that. Some people, you know, need to go in. Well, let me just say this. You can practice the pause in less triggered moments, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of trying to get to the pause when we're talking about sex or money, which is a super hot topic in our relationship, in the given relationship of this hypothetical person. Talk about the pause when your partner says you left the garage door open. The snow got in the, you know, garage, and you're not super triggered, but now you have an opportunity to do something different instead of snapping back. Well, you lost the keys yesterday. You're no one to talk. You can kind of take that pause, and you're wiring your nervous system. You're practicing around smaller moments. I think I'm a huge fan of somatic experiencing therapy, which is that, you know, just learning to get into your body. We're not being taught from a young age the mind body connection, and it's, you know, it can start to sound so cliche, and it's just so powerful, as you know, as a acupuncturist, you know.
The unofficial tagline of Fried is pee when you have to pee, because of these basic, like, we call it foundational self-care here. And it's even before you can get to that stage of higher regulation, start by noticing when you're thirsty and having a drink of water. Noticing when you're cold and asking, is it okay if I go grab a blanket and some socks? Noticing when you're antsy and it's time to move. Noticing when you're hungry and it's time to eat. Peeing when you have to pee. Just these very simple, basic reactions that help to tell your body that it's safe, which can help you create the pause also.
Absolutely. And it's kind of the same concept. You're working in areas where it's a little easier. It's easier to recognize when I need to pee. It's harder when I need to recognize when I need to set a boundary.
Right.
But my brain's kind of learned with the peeing thing. So.
Yeah. So now you're validating the things that I talk about. So now we've got this thing going on back and forth. I like it.
Great. Great. You're feeling your emotions.
My husband and his friends used to have real long conversations in bars. And at the end, they would say, let's get together again next week and talk about how much we all agree with one another.
I love it. I love
it. Yeah, me too. So let's talk communication skills.
Okay.
I'm just going to leave that there and let you go wherever you want.
Well, so communication skills, just that term sounds kind of heady.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really more hearty, you know, heart with a T, not a D. And that's what's really kind of missing. I mean, it's pretty easy to learn I statements and, you know, these kind of like rote ways of stringing words together. But there's this other piece that's really missing, which is stringing those words together with actual heart and authenticity and a felt sense of empathy. And that's what I'm really bringing to the table here. I think it's really easy to, you know, you can find any number of books written to give you these words and ways to structure things. But if people aren't learning how to access the emotions that go along with those words and tie it all together, it's not only might not be effective, it could actually make things worse, because then people feel kind of patronized, or, you know, they can sense the inauthenticity in that. So I'm really just trying to say, hey, here's the words. Here's why I'm stringing these words together in this way. And the words in of themselves are meant to be much safer and from less of a blaming place. But I also really need you to tap into your emotions. So this is coming from your heart. You know, if someone is talking to you in a way that's not from their heart, I mean, our nervous systems just instantly know it.
Know
we
that.
Know where your heart is, no matter what words you're saying. Now, there's something to be said for just trying to say new words, because that is communicating, I care about you and I'm trying over here, right?
Yeah.
So that's important too. And sometimes just saying that, look, I might not be getting the words exactly right. I'm trying new words, but let me tell you something. I'm doing it because I love you and I love us. And I want to start doing something new.
And I want to feel closer and connected and supported and understood and validated and...
Yes. And I want you to feel those things. Yeah.
Hmm. A lot of us burnt out folk have given a lot to other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We get stuck in these cycles of overgiving again, likely trying to meet an attachment need.
Absolutely.
And it often doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
That attachment need is not met, but we keep trying and then we burn ourselves out. We get burned out. I wonder if there are people listening that are like, oh my God, I'm supposed to like be the big person again. Like I'm supposed to try more. Like, I feel like I'm the one that's doing everything all the time anyway. When do I get to take stuff? Like, when do I get to get stuff?
Mm-hmm. I know that that's really hard. I think that the difference here is when you really get adept at doing this work. Are you there? It looks like, okay, I thought you were frozen. You're just really still. When you're really good at doing this work, it's actually less exhausting than the alternative, not more exhausting. It is a way of giving, but you're really, you know, we need to reframe this as giving to yourself and giving to an environment. And yeah, you might not be getting back from your partner what you're needing. I hope that you get that. I really do. And I think that there's a lot of value in working on yourself and working on the environment that is going to create the safety in the relationship and the environment that does lend itself to people starting to put their defenses down and self-reflect and start showing up as their best self because they start realizing their own needs for it. But no matter what, this work is about a gift to yourself. It's about you being your best self for you. And it's hard because we associate self-work and all these ways of showing up as our best self in the relationship with giving to another in this exhausting way. But if it's exhausting in that way, I mean, it's hard. It's really kind of hard to explain it, but it's like, if you're exhausted by thinking that you're giving to your partner, you're exhausted with a whole lot of things in your life.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the other message that's trying to come through in your words, and correct me if I'm off, is when the giving is exhausting like that, it's not really true giving. It's sort of like an act.
Well, it's an attempt at control, and it's exhausting because you're not, your expectations are skewed. So it is, if your expectations are, I'm doing this because I want something in return and you're not getting it in return. I mean, that's demoralizing.
I want to cheer to the high heavens when you say that. But it's something I write about in my book. Like, if that's your goal, if that's what you're in this for, then that's not, then you are, and not be, you're doing it because this is how you learned how to do it. It's not your fault. But instead of actually trying to get your needs met, you're trying to manipulate situations so that your needs get met. And it just doesn't work.
It's this indirect way of going about it. And you put your power in the hands of other people and all these other things that you really don't have power over. That is exhausting. That is an exhausting way to live.
This just makes me so happy to hear from your perspective. The last thing that I want to talk about today, and listen, Fried Fam, I could be talking to Julie for about 900 hours because there's a lot to cover. And this book, her book covers, the book is called Secure Love. Once again, it will be in the show notes as per usual. But this book covers so many things that we talk about in other ways on this podcast. And if something hasn't found its home in your heart yet, if you've heard things and they haven't quite clicked, Julie's book is another way to get them in there and to get them to click. Sometimes you just need a different sentence, a different cadence, a different structure around it. So I really want to encourage you wholeheartedly to dive into this because I truly believe that this work is at the core of what we need for burnout recovery.
I really do believe that too. It's all so related. It's not just about relationships. It's just about a worldview or a life view or a spiritual view. And I use the context of relationships to get it there.
Yeah, but it works all over the place. So as we get towards the end, the last thing that I want to cover that I think is another hot topic, and I say that on purpose in here, is the anatomy of a trigger, responding to a trigger, this whole concept. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to take a little deep dive into it for my people.
Okay. So what I do in my work is I help people organize themselves and make sense of themselves so that they have something to work with as far as their communication goes. And this is part of like finding their heart, finding what is underneath these, you know, behaviors and words that we're doing that aren't working. It even just overworking and the things that lead to burnout. I could use as an example, you know, you're with your family and you're supposed to be spending time together. And all of a sudden, you know, you have this urge to check your phone and check your email. I mean, we know that those behaviors, when they're chronic, and they're going to lead to burnout, right? And I'm guilty. I'm just putting my hand up here. But what it is when you have that urge to look at your phone, there's a number of things happening in your body that if you don't have words for that, if you don't have an understanding and a way to organize and make sense of that, for you, it's just kind of a chaotic feeling of urgency. And I'm wanting to really help people slow down with that moment, right? This one moment, this one split second where this urge, what's happening in your body? Well, I feel a tension. What is that tension saying? It's like an anxiety. Anxious about what? I need to see what's going on in the email at work. I need what happened if you don't? I don't know. Things could fall apart. I'll miss something. I'll miss a deal, or I'll miss the dopamine hit of something good that happened. And, you know, what's the meaning there, right? I kind of just described the meaning, but what is the kind of deeper stuff? Like, what happens if you do miss it? What happens if work does fall apart? Well, I lose everything. What happens if you lose everything? I'm a loser. I'm a failure. I'll be alone. There's a lot of sadness around there. People who fear that have experienced that somewhere in their life. Mm-hmm. They had grief around that they didn't have any help with. So they had to shove it down. So much unprocessed grief around that, so much unexamined fear. And then your body starts to amp up and you get these feelings of this, like the urgent and the anxious. And then all of a sudden, what do? You check the phone. Yes. And that is reinforcing the behaviors that lead to burnout. And this can show up in the way you communicate with your partner. Let's say you are with your partner, and now what message are they giving? Oh, they're not there. They don't care about me. They don't really want to connect. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to actually stay safe in the world by checking that email, actually feel okay, actually feel a sense of, you know, emotional fulfillment that you might not know how to get in relationships. This is your way of feeling understood. This is your way of feeling respected and all these attachment needs. So how are you ever going to learn to do something new and not look at that phone if you're not really sure what you're needing and what's going on inside of you anyway?
So at least on a smaller scale with things that are maybe a little less serious and intense, if you're the urge to pick up your phone, what if you just explored that for like a week? You'd probably learn a shit ton.
This is where the pause can happen.
Right.
It's easier to develop that pause with your phone for a lot of people than it is when you're in a very heated, difficult conversation with, you know, in the area where the emotional stakes are the highest with your partner. So this is where we practice the pauses.
I love it. The last thing that I want to talk about, which is probably not actually the last thing, but the last thing that we have time for.
Yeah.
Is the idea that even once you figure out what the needs are, allowing other people to help you meet them is a challenge for so many of us. So do you have any advice for people on how to let people in, how to let the needs get in?
Yeah. So that would be, you know, I'm always looking at blocks, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a block. It's with the partners I treat, which is, even when your partner is kind of trying to show up for you emotionally, you don't want it because you have these ideas that support and help. And there's weakness around that. There's shame around that. You're too much. If you ask for too much, they're eventually going to go away. You don't trust it. And so again, we're going to have to really, really narrow this down to a moment, right? And that moment is your partner's over there going, tell me more about your feelings. And all of a sudden, you clench up. The wall goes up. What happens right there? There's meanings. I'm weak. I can't take this in. Only weak people need help and comfort. You know, my body's tensing up. My nervous system is having this fear. You know, all these things are happening at once. And let's kind of pick this apart and figure it out and start putting some more words to it so that you can learn, okay, maybe it is kind of safe for me to allow it in, or you can at least be able to say to your partner, this is one of those moments where I'm recognizing you're over there trying to reach for me. And I'm recognizing this wall's going up because I'm scared. Mm. At least you're not just habitually going into that wall. Now, what message are you sending your partner when the wall goes up? Don't bother. I don't want you in here. You're not welcome in my world, or you'll never get it right, no matter how hard you try. And paradoxically, there's so many anxious partners who do this. They're begging for it, begging for it, begging for it. And then they get it, wall.
Mm. Right, fam. This was a lot to think about. So if you need to give yourself a few days and then a re-listen with a notebook, I would do that. And then I would go grab Julie's book, Secure Love. And then I would actually, no, in between, I would follow Julie on Instagram because her account should not be missed. It's at The Secure Relationship. So don't miss that. And then get the book and start diving in, because working through this one particular thing will help you work through so many of your other burnout adjacent things.
Yeah, for sure.
Julie, do you have any parting? I have this thing that's stuck in my body that needs to wiggle out before we finish.
I did think of something just now and I lost it, but I really feel, you know, kind of like I'm in this mission to get this word out. And I do feel like it's a very good book. I really do. I have a lot of confidence in it, and I hope. And, you know, I would say this too, you know, if you don't want to get the book, don't go to Instagram. Like I don't have anything hidden behind a paywall. It's just not very, you know, it's not organized and it's not as much in depth as I could go in the book, because you're limited in all these ways in social media, but it really is all on social media in some way or another.
Get the book anyway. When I got on the phone with Julie to start today, I said, listen, I spent the past, you know, day and a half reading your book, and it is one of those books that comes across every couple years that just hits you right where it needs to. And I think will hold a really special place for a long, long time. This is a Brené Brown level book. This is,
wow.
This is that kind of book. I haven't read one like this in a long time.
Well, so, that's a huge honor to me. My heart is really exploding right now. Thank you. The first time
anyone. I'm happy to bestow that gratitude and good faith on you, because I really, it's really magical. So Fried Fam, learn to let it in, learn to let it out. And if your giving is exhausting you, it might not be the right kind. I'll see you in the Facebook group. Can't wait to hear what you think about this episode. And we'll see you in a week. Until next time.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.